So welcome this Shabbat. It is June 4th, 2016. It's a special service here at Narkis because it's Chuck's retirement party in the worship service. Not connected to our parasha. Let's start with word of prayer, several words. Lord, thank you for the Bible, preserved for us, given to us. Thank you how we can dig in deeper and get more and more and see more things we never saw before. And I pray for each of us you would renew that sense of excitement at finding hidden treasure, and that you would give little gems, even if at first they appear rocks, that we can work on, and it can impact our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
So, studying the Bible, as you know, is not fast food. And that's why there are so many people at our Bible study. Because we as humans like fast food. And we prefer somebody else to do all the work for us. But there's something special about trying to study the Bible. Even if you don't have the language, whatever, I really believe that God blesses the act of just trying to understand it. And it's through that he somehow speaks to us, wherever we're at. If you add to it languages, it gets even more colorful and interesting. And to me personally, it inspires my faith because I see what a beautiful work the Bible was, that to me it's just impossible to explain it by just a bunch of people wrote it. All the connections I see, it's just impossible. I'll go ahead and close this door for now. Many hands wrote it, many personalities, different languages, different dialects, different times, and yet you see all these interconnections in both words and ideas. So today we're looking at Joseph. We are in... Do you all have a Bible? Do you need a Bible, Heather? No, you know it all. Okay, because we're going to do some reading.
I just read it all.
Okay. Well, then you can do some listening, which, in fact, I highly recommend. If you have a recorded Bible, to listen without reading, especially if you can do it in Hebrew, but in any language, it's strange, but you notice different things when you listen and you're not reading. It's very fascinating. I've done it on the bus, and I've heard connections I never saw before when I was reading it. So I recommend that doing that sometime.
Can you repeat that sentence? You said there are amazing interconnections in ideas. You just had an amazing sentence, and I wanted to repeat it.
You'll have to go to the recording.
If it gets on there.
If I try to repeat it now, I'll...
Ideas, stories.
Well, about the Bible, just that there's amazing interconnections.
Okay, I got that.
But then I was moving on to the point of the value of actually listening to a story as opposed to reading it, listening only. You hear different connections than when you're reading it. So Genesis 37 is about Joseph and his brothers and that whole relationship there. And then we have two interesting passages in Isaiah and Ezekiel that move more into the national theme. And so you kind of go from the personal, the story, and of course any story, the beauty of a story is you can interpret it different directions. So if you want to, obviously, founding father stories, you're going to be thinking nationally as well. And so Joseph being sold into Egypt parallels, you know, everybody thinks about Israel and Egypt, right? And Israel coming, the promise that Israel would come out of Egypt. And so those kind of themes will connect us to the prophets there. And I wonder if there might be some more themes of words that connect us up, which we'll get to. Hold on. I'm going to pull out my Genesis 37. So we have one chapter. Why don't we go ahead and read? Jem, if you can start us off, and everyone just take a chunk.
Genesis 37,
Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he'd been born to him in his old age, and he made an ornate robe for him. When his brothers saw their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field, when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he'd said. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in his mind. Should I go on or should somebody else go?
Someone else can carry on. Stephanie or whoever. Say what verse you were in, Gemma.
I'm in 37:12.
Verse 12, yeah.
Now his brothers.
Very well, he replied, yeah?
Yeah.
So he said to them, "Go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me." Then he sent them off from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, "What are you looking for?" He replied, "I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they are, raising their flocks? They have moved on from here," the man answered. "I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.' So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. Here comes the dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that him. For I will devour him. Then we see what comes of his dreams." When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he said. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him into this cistern here in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said, "This is rescuing him from them and taking him back to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they tried to off his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty, there was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a couple of Israelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, palm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brother, "What will we gain if we will kill our brother and cover his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Israelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he's our brother, our own flesh and blood, his brother and priest." So the Midianites merchants came by. His brother pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Israelites who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to his sister and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brother and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They took the ornate robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it is your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It's my son's robe. So through his enemies devoured him, Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, but on his sackcloth and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters came to confront him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "I'll continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Median saw Joseph to report to Potiphar, one of the Pharaoh's officials, to the captain of the guard.
Okay. There you have the story.
Can I ask one question?
You can ask, sure, one question. What
it's
is it?
Just right at the beginning, 2037, 2. It doesn't sound right in the English. Joseph, a young man of 17, blah, blah, blah. And he brought their father a bad report about them. And these he's and them's also, I mean, we assume it's the boys bringing their father a bad report about Joseph.
No, no. Why do we assume that?
Well,
okay, first of all, the framework of this story is interesting, right? Jacob is dwelling in the land where his father dwelt, in Canaan.
Canaan, right.
So this is also significant. You're living as a foreigner in this land. And then this is the history of Yaakov. And then, boom, it goes straight to this Joseph story. It's like, right. Usually when you get the toldot, you get a bunch of descendants.
Right.
But this is a story. So in that framework, it's an interesting way to think about it. And the first information you're given is background information about Joseph, that he is 17 years old, that he is a shepherd with his brothers with the sheep and goats. And then it says, Vehu na'ar et bnei Bilha vet bnei Silpah.
So it's Joseph who's going to his father.
Hold on, we haven't got there. He is a na'ar et bnei Bilha. So you could say, na'ar is one of those words. It means young man. It can mean child, youth. It's also a servant, regardless of their age. But here we know that he is 17, so he is a young man. But could it also be he is a servant, because it has the accusative after that. To, either with or to, the sons of Bilha or the sons of Zilpah. So the two ways of understanding this are either he's a young kid that tags along with Bilha and Zilpah's sons, or he's actually a servant of Bilha and Zilpah. Now, everyone here, I think, comes from cultures where we don't have many wives. Am I right? If you come from a culture that has many wives, there are certain built-in feelings you have when you hear information like this. There's a big deal between a first wife and a second wife. First wife is in command. Second wife is basically her servant. So their children, it's the same way. The first wife's children are in command. You know, they are more prestigious. They get more. The second wife's children are lower. And it's interesting here, not only does it gives a general statement that Joseph is with all his brothers, but it specifies who? The sons of? Bilha and Zilpah. Not even Leah and Rachel, but Bilha and Zilpah. I mean, obviously, Yosef is from Rachel. But so they are the servants of Leah and Rachel, which it does say Neshe Aviv, so the wives of his father. There's a fine line whether you call them concubines or wives. In terms of status, I assume, well, I know, Leah would be number one, Rachel's number two, and then the concubines. Probably Leah's concubine would be a higher status than Rachel's concubine. So it's like that. But anyway, so he's with the lower ranking kids, and it seems like he is the lowest, certainly in age, but also maybe in status. So he's way down at the bottom of the ring. And it tells us all that at the beginning of the story, because that is important information for us understanding. And then, what does he do? He brings a bad report. And it's interesting, diba is not such a common word in the Bible. It means a bad report. It can be slander, it can be whispering, rumor, but it's negative. And it also says ra'ah, which is another word for bad. So it's a bad report. to their father. Now,
to whose father?
To all Jacob. Of their father. They all share a father. That would be Jacob. So Joseph has been with his brothers, either serving them or serving them. And they've been out with the sheep and the goats, and now he brings a report back to his father that they've been doing something wrong. Or they're not, I don't know, are they not taking care of the goats well enough? Did they let one get eaten? What could this bad report be?
We don't know, do we?
We don't know, but it's bad. To give you a sense, the interesting thing about it is, okay, do you remember the spy story in Numbers 13? Does everyone remember spy story?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There were 12 spies. What did 10 of them say?
That the land was too overpopulated with
The land is good, but the inhabitants are giants, they're going to eat us, and so they kind of presented it in a negative way. And it says several times in the Numbers 13 and 14, it uses this word
debah,
to bring a bad report about the land. So in that sense, it's, I don't know, it's correct information, but it's spun in a way that makes it look negative. So it's interesting, as you look in the other places where this word comes, it comes a couple times in Proverbs, once in Psalms, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, all of them, well, especially the wisdom literature like Proverbs, it's a negative word. It's more like slander. So that to me makes me ask a question, in Joseph's case, what was it? Is it just a neutral bad report? Is he just he's just telling the truth? Or is he spinning the truth negatively against them? And I don't know, it's open to interpretation, as so many things are. But let's assume he's just a good boy, and he's too naive to realize that he is at the bottom of the rank. And even if it is the truth, to go against all your brothers, you are going to be creating enemies. Like, he might not have figured that out. So he goes to his father and says what he says. Or maybe he does know that, and he's just so honest that he has to give this bad report.
Or
because it was so bad.
He's his favorite son of his father. He may be at the lower end of the pole, but his mother is the favorite wife.
Right, and he knows it.
And he knows it.
And you could argue that based on the very next verse. And by the way, Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was son in his old age. And then it also gives us important information about the Ktonet Pasim. And that's, everybody knows Joseph and what? Joseph and what do you call it?
Technicolor dream coat. I don't understand.
Technicolor dream coat.
It was one of the biggest shows ever. You know it, don't you?
Is it Broadway?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. What does everyone's translations have for this coat? Describe the coat.
Ornate robe.
Ornate robe, okay. Anyone else?
Richly ornamented robe.
Ornamented robe?
Richly
ornamented.
Ornamented,
okay. What else?
You need a Bible. What language are you? Do you want a Bible?
Yeah,
there's one right out here.
How's your Hebrew? I can't do numbers. Find me chapter 37.
Handle came off of my hand. So richly ornamented, a stripe back here. What did you say in French?
No.
What do you have?
We're trying to figure out the Italian.
Italian. Okay, what does it say in Italian?
Just wait till we figure it out.
Mm. Has he got an Italian?
Yeah.
So today, in Hebrew, pasim are stripes.
Pasim.
Yeah, pas is a stripe. Right?
Yeah.
You know that word? Apparently, in the Bible, according to one dictionary, it's it can be the palm of the hand or the sole of the foot. Now, that was strange to me when I looked that up, and I would want to confirm it with another Bible because it didn't really make sense. But where else in the Bible? There's one other place where there's a kutonet pasim. One other place in the Bible. And who can guess?
It's not in Isaiah, is it?
It's not in Isaiah.
This is the chapter.
It's in another story. It's not even in the Torah. So think in the prophets, in 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings.
David?
No.
Gehazi?
No. Nice guess, though, because it did deal with clothes in that story. I thought someone would guess Samuel, but that's not Kutonet Pasim. It is in the story of Amnon and Tamar. Tamar.
We keep going back to that story.
Yeah. Before we jump there, let me just say, Kutonet Pasim, one way to understand it is it could be an ornately woven robe. It could also be a long robe, something that comes full-length sleeves. If you take the pasim as the palms of your hands or your ankles, it would be a full-length garment. Whatever it is, we know for sure that it set him apart from his brothers. But where we get a coat of many colors is from the Greek translation. So that was done 250 BC. So it's one of our earliest translations. So when we stumble in Hebrew and we're like, what does that mean? We often go to a translation done, you know, almost 1,000 years before the English. And you often find interesting things, one being a coat of many colors, pukilion. Many colored or various kinds. Like there's something about it that's multi-colored, multi-dimensional, I don't know. And I guess that's what technicolor means. Okay, so let's go to the other place. 2 Samuel 13:18. Samuel 13:18. Why? Oh, it's...
This time it's Tamar wearing it.
Tamar, exactly. This time it's a girl wearing the garment.
But it's richly ornamented.
You still have richly ornamented.
Yeah.
Well, that's... No, that's... It's the same word. Actually, your translation's nice because it's allowed you to see that link where other translations may not. What do you have in verse 18?
A robe of many colors.
A robe of many colors. Wow. That's very interesting because it's not in the Greek. In the Joseph story, it's a robe of many colors. But in the Greek, in this story, it's not. It's a long-sleeved robe. So I heard that over here, long-sleeved.
I've got an ornate robe again, which is... So this was the kind of garments the virgin daughters of the king wore.
Ornate robe,
yeah. Ornate robe is exactly the same translation as in the Genesis.
Yeah. So...
What translation is Inga using?
Inga's translation is just based on everybody knows Jacob's many-colored robe, right? And
yeah.
So when you see the exact same words together, you want to translate it according to the first time. But
of course, for Joseph, it was like prophetic because he would be a king, right?
Yeah, well, whatever it is, it's something kingly. It's something special.
Yeah.
We know that.
So the Italian has another word here.
Okay, it quite well would be. But the Greek translation in the two different places are different, as is my English. My English says, now she was wearing a long robe, for this is what the king's virgin daughters used to wear. And it's that long robe that she tears. She tore the long robe, again it says.
But in Hebrew it's the same in the two places?
Kutonet pasim. It's the same exact two words together. Well, as we mentioned, pasim, apparently in the Bible, that's also a weird word. And in the BDB, in one of the standard dictionaries, it gives it as a palm or a sole of the foot, not a stripe. Which, I don't know, I'm sure the interpretation stripe is coming from somewhere.
I'm picturing tie-dye.
Yeah, it might be coming from the Aramaic translation, which I do have here, but I didn't look at. Let's just see this really quick and go back to Genesis.
Why not? How did you do it otherwise?
Why do we care about this anyway? Well, for one, it gives you links to other stories that you wouldn't find. When you have a word that's only two stories in the Bible, and it's a specific word, oftentimes you naturally connect the stories in your mind, and the one story helps you interpret the other, or somehow colors it. They might be totally different, but there might be some thread, no pun intended, that weaves them together. So
there's no connection where, I think Isaiah talks about sort of robes of righteousness and...
There's many words for robes.
Right.
This particular one only comes twice in the Bible.
Okay.
It's Genesis
with the pasim.
37.
Kutonet pasim.
Yeah, kutonet is often translated tunic.
Yeah.
It's a robe of the priests have it.
Right.
And actually the first time it comes in the Bible is our story with Adam and Eve. Right? God makes them a kutonet out of leather.
Right.
Because it's a little bit more durable than a fig leaf. Now, let me go back to, what verse were we in? Okay, so, kutonet pasim. No, I don't have that targum. Oh, never mind, that might take me too long. Okay. So probably long sleeve, probably not multicolored, maybe fancily embroidered. That makes sense. All right. So it sets him apart, and we know that he is feeling favored, and maybe it's that feeling of knowing that you're favored that allows him to dare to bring a bad report against his older brothers who have much more clout than him. And it's interesting. Okay, so this is an event, and it just says his brothers hated him, and they were not able to speak about him or speak to him, it's unclear. Le shalom. We talked about this word shalom last time. Of course, we all know it means peace. It also means well-being, and I heard many translations kindly. Like, they couldn't come up with a good thing to say about him or to him. Maybe they just couldn't refrain from fighting with him, basically. So there's this idea of peace, or the opposite of peace, in relating to Joseph. And I think that's a theme that connects us up to these other things. Because in the prophet section, there is peace and security. Where in the Joseph story, we see a lack of peace and a lack of security. Okay. And so then after his dream, he tells his brothers, I don't know why he does that, and they continue to hate him more. All right, so that's the second time hate's mentioned. And so then he tells them the dream. I mean, he must really be out to lunch. I don't know. Does anyone have another way of understanding it that makes him not incredibly just
either snotty or
a mixture of both, proud, a mixture of being proud or pampered and not understanding how politically bad you are behaving? I don't know.
Unwise, especially.
Unwise, yeah. And actually, Joseph, if you look at his story, it's very much a wisdom story. And he is the epitome of wise in his older years. So it's very interesting here that you just get the opposite. And remember, I mentioned this word, dibah. If you look in Proverbs, it says specifically about Diba, the one who brings Diba, a bad report, is a fool, right? And what a fool is the opposite of wise. So in a sense, our first picture of Joseph is the opposite of what he will become later.
He does
go through a lot of suffering. And maybe that's how God gets us all to be wise, is we suffer.
You can imagine if there's a rivalry or a back and forth going on, it's like, well, hey, you know.
I'll get you back.
Yeah.
It could be. It could be that the we don't know what this bad report is, but what if the bad report involved himself? And so he felt he had been mistreated by his brothers, and to get them back,
To get back at them,
exactly. He goes to his father. And maybe there was some ongoing tension back and forth.
Very likely was, if they couldn't say a kind word to him.
Right.
What's interesting is it's actually something that Florence said last night, but it relates to what we've been talking about, is the way a name means something, and it can be very nasty, and then it changes. I mean, obviously, somebody right. like Jacob, he's a deceiver, and he's a this and he's that, and he becomes Israel, somebody who struggles with God. And even within a name, the character of somebody changes.
So
and
Yosef, this is a little bit let the same. Him add?
What?
Let him add? What are you going off of Yosef's name, or?
Well, it doesn't matter about, no, talking about Jacob.
Oh, okay, Jacob,
yeah,
okay.
I mean, it doesn't
okay.
matter. I was thinking more about the way a personality changes. Here
right.
we've got a tactless young man
right.
who basically winds up his brother something shocking. And he's everything that is unwise, and yet we know later on
he is.
He becomes the epitome of wisdom.
It's interesting. Vayosifu od sno, but I mean that's too common a phrase to say it's playing with the name of Yosef.
Yeah, so I wasn't thinking it's
playing
with the name so much as the way a character
right.
changed, where none of us stuck.
Sure, there's
in the sins
a character
of our youth,
flip.
Let's say.
So after the first dream, we have a report that they hate him, and then they say, are you going to reign over us? Hamaloch timloch alenu, im mashol timshol banu. And this reminds me of what story? Are you going to come rule over us and reign over us? Does that ring any bell?
I was thinking of the trees.
Another, yeah, trees. Who did it? Why?
It's
Yotam's parable.
Judges chapter 9.
Again, we have a younger son of a concubine.
Right, Aminabash.
Who's trying to reign over legitimate sons. So we have the same type of tension of the underdog, and they say, well, are you going to come rule over us? And so that's another interesting connection. And again, you could go to that story and see how the two help you interpret. One helps interpret the other. But then it says, again, and they continue to hate him even more. So this is the third time they've added one layer of hate, another hate, and the third hate.
What's the word
and
for
of course,
hate, Sina?
Snow is hating. Li snows to hate. So
right
now they hate him because of his dreams and because of his words or things or speech. So maybe it's referring to the bad report. Maybe it's just the way he talks in general. We don't know. Okay, so then he has another dream, and you think by this time he would have learned, but no, he goes and tells his brothers. So I do think there's a little bit of, he's intentionally trying to get back at them. Because why would he do it? Surely he perceives that they hate them.
But we then get the much later story.
Wait, we can't skip much later.
Well, I was thinking of these two dreams, and the whole thing about two
being confirmative.
If the Lord says it twice, it's fixed in heaven.
But at this point, his father rebukes him.
Yeah.
Right? And he's like, really? Are we all going to bow down to you?
This is also
that the father kept the matter in his mind, in his heart, which
yeah.
reminded me of Mary.
Of Mary, exactly.
Yeah.
It's that same idiom here in Hebrew, there in Greek.
It seems like he rebukes publicly, but privately he thinks something different. So he's
yeah.
doing what's good for the family publicly.
Or he's saying, like, that can't possibly, but it's so strange that it makes him think.
Yeah.
First of all, it's the second dream, like you say. It's kind of been confirmed. And people took dreams seriously.
The other thing is, I think we're maybe beginning to see the beginning of a gifting or something God uses him in later years, but he doesn't yet know how to do it with, you know,
It's like you, with wisdom, yeah, you often, you might see the beginnings of something that there's a gift or a, something
yeah.
that you've been given, but when you start to use it, you may make mistakes.
Yeah. So then his brothers go to be a shepherd with the sheep in Shechem. And you notice Yosef is not with them. And so then, we have a name change here, Israel instead of Yaakov. Israel sends Jacob, and he says, look, aren't your brothers being shepherds in Shechem? Go, I'm sending you to them. And he says, okay. It's strange, because it seems like they were separated on purpose, and now he's sending them back again to check on the brothers. And so he says, go and see their well-being. Again, the word shalom. Look at the well-being of your brothers and the well-being of the sheep. And bring me back a davar. Bring me back a word. So he wants another report. So maybe whatever the bad report was originally, the father doesn't trust the other sons and he wants to send Joseph again. And he knows Joseph's going to tell him the truth. And so he says, bring me back a davar. And it could be that the brothers were really bad, and they were upset that he kept tattling on them. You know? So he goes off, and we have this strange story where someone meets him in a field. Probably what that story is doing is separating the events. Intermediate, like if you were to put this in drama, you need an intermediary scene. Because we need to see Joseph coming from a distance. And you're not just going to jump, yeah, I'll go, and then he goes. You need him to be somewhere temporarily. And then they look up and they see him from a distance and they make their plans. That's all a little bit literary. You can come up with another explanation if you want. Okay. So they see him from a distance, and before he came to them, they made an evil plan to kill him. And they're making fun of him. Look at this dreamer. And they plan to throw his body in a cistern, right? And it's interesting that here, their plan is to throw his body in a cistern and to say what? How do they explain his death? In verse 20, look at verse 20, what does it say?
The animal had eaten him.
Yeah, so they plan to murder him and claim animals ate him. And it's interesting because they don't end up murdering him.
But they actually carry out the same
plan. But they do carry out their cover-up plan of animals eating him. And what will become of all his dreams? So again, twice they've mentioned the dreams, so it appears that they do take those dreams seriously. Even though they don't admit it, they're still thinking about the dreams. Because what will become of those dreams now if we kill him, you know? And so Reuben he has cold feet and wants to save him. And he says, let's not kill him. Don't spill blood. We all know that's bad. And
I
then
keep making a link in my head with the very end of the story, which I know is very naughty. But when the brothers finally come to him, right at the end in Egypt, that their anxiety is that he, Joseph, is going to have the same hate
towards
them.
Oh, for sure, because they deserved it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting that all these years later, here we've got a 17-year-old kid, and I don't know how old,
the kind of thing you forget.
I know, but it's...
So here, Reuben says to throw him in the cistern, and what does he specifically say? Asher bamidbar, that is in the wilderness. So what's the implication there? Have you been out in the wilderness recently on a day like yesterday?
Yeah. And there's no water.
There's no water in the cistern. What would happen to you?
You'd die of thirst fast.
You would die if you couldn't climb out of that cistern. So he's saying, let's achieve the same results, but we won't be directly guilty because we're just throwing him in there. We didn't actually spill his blood. We weren't the ones who killed him. You know, we know he's going to die of thirst, but it wasn't us. And of course, our narrator tells us that he really had plans to come back and save him. But that's not revealed to his brothers.
In some cultures, it makes a big difference if difference whether you spill someone's blood or you don't.
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm sure even in a legal court, you could make arguments, or the severity of the punishment may change. But they take off this special coat he has, long sleeve coat, whatever it was, and they throw him in the cistern. Oh, that's where it's mentioned that has no water. And they sit down to eat. So they're pictured, anyone who can do like a very disturbing act and then just sit down and eat, they're kind of calloused. They're being pictured as very calloused. And they look up and they see some Ishmaelim. And of course they're coming, where's Gilad? If you're, let's say this is the map of Israel.
The map of the north.
Up here, right? So in Gilad, there are nice stuff. Caravans come from Gilad because what does it have? What's it famous for?
Spices.
Balm, particularly, but yeah, spices. So they're carrying all this stuff to go down to Egypt. They're traders. Ishmaelim are traders, Ishmaelites. And they're going down to Egypt. And so Judah says to his brothers, you know, what are we going to get out of killing him? Let's just sell him. Okay, if you look at the law, selling somebody, and in later interpretation, is like killing them if you sell a brother. But that could be coming from this story. But so they want to sell him. And what price do they get?
20 shekels.
20 shekels. What does that strike you as?
It's less than the 30 shekels of silver.
If I remember right, I didn't have a chance to check it, but I'm pretty sure it's 10 shekels under. The number I'm thinking is 30 shekels.
Yeah.
So if I'm right, and you can all go back, do your homework and check on me. If I'm right, they're not just selling him, they're underselling him, below a slave price.
So 30 shekels.
And that's really, you know,
scuzzy. 30 shekels.
Right.
Yeah, yeah,
so
you're right.
That is the real price.
30, the real price.
But is that 30 shekels? Is that a slave price or is that?
Have to look it up.
There are, yeah, I'm sorry, yeah. I didn't have time for that. There are sections of the Bible where it specifies based on the age. So it could be an age consideration. But a 17-year-old guy in good condition because he's a pampered kid, that should be a high price for a slave. I mean, I would pay a full slave price for that. But not that I would pay a slave price, but
in that culture, you might.
Yeah.
No, but it's interesting.
No, I hope not. Okay, so the interesting thing, the text here is in verse 28. We have a little bit of repetition. It says Midianim now. Midianites, not Ishmaelites, but maybe it's mixed, and maybe this is just a way of referring to those who control the caravans, and they could be Midianites or Ishmaelites. But it's not clear. It says they drew him up from the cistern, and they sold Yosef to the Ishmaelites. And I was just thinking as I read it, you could argue that the Midianites pulled him up and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites. It's a weird argument because before we have Judah saying, let's sell him. But it's there. It's strange. It's strange that they would repeat it. But let's assume it's the brothers, because brothers selling brothers is a high, high crime. And selling it for 20 shekels, I think, is equally high crime. And he goes down to Egypt. And so then Reuben comes back and, of course, rips his clothes. And that, we talked about the connections with Judah, sorry, Amnon and Tamar.
She tore
her clothes, and there's these connections of mourning and tearing clothes. And so there's several strands linking those two stories. And there, again, it's a sibling problem, right? It's a treachery that's going to lead to sibling, leads to murder is what it leads to get back. And so we're being set up here in the same kind of incident where Joseph, the atrocities done to him deserve vengeance. And I think that is important when we go on in the story of Joseph, because all these terrible things happening to him, granted he is a punk, but still, these atrocities are beyond what you could argue he deserves. And the, another interesting thing for those who care, I remember hearing in a class that, you know, when the father Jacob rips his garments and he can't be comforted, he says, "I will go down mourning to Sheol." We, you know, that exact phrase has been found in other ancient literature. So that's just a nice little ancient idiom thing in there. And
but
I know that was a very general statement.
Tearing of clothes is still part of Jewish practice and ritual.
And then again in verse 36, the Midianim sell him to Egypt. General statement, to Egypt. And then it specifies to Potiphar, the guard of Pharaoh.
You notice in verse 33, he says it, Jacob says it, "It's my son's robe, some animal is torn into pieces." They don't actually have to even say it.
Yeah.
They just don't correct it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So somewhere along the lines, they came up with a good plan.
Sharon?
Yes.
Leviticus 27.
Uh-huh. Leviticus 27, what verse?
5. From 5 to 20 years old, the estimation of a male is 20 shekels.
Oh.
Well done.
Okay. So it goes to 20.
To 20. And then at 20 on
and
is?
And then it's older, from 20 to 60, it is 50 shekels.
Ooh, the price really jumps. Yeah. Sorry, young guys.
So.
Gotta wait till you're 20 to really count. Okay, well that makes sense. I mean, you get your best strength probably mid-20s. All right, so he was sold at a fair price. We'll give you that.
Wait a minute.
A fair price for a slave, but still we don't sell our brothers as slaves. That is considered a crime. On par, in some places, with murder. So I want to make another comment as we're going to go now read our Isaiah passage. Do you guys know the word beged?
Clothes.
Clothes, yeah. It's just your general clothes word. It could be a fancy robe, t-shirt, whatever. Kutonet's the word we've been looking at, right?
Like a long shirt, is it?
There's another word beged. That means
treachery.
Treachery.
Yeah.
CH.
CH.
Like that?
Yeah.
Treachery. This livgod against somebody is to betray them, to be unfaithful, to deal treacherously. Depending on the context, it'll be translated slightly different. But there is a noun in Isaiah that is that same word. And why do I mention this? Because the way you tell a story can work on the outside of your thinking and imagination. And all this dealing with clothes, even though they haven't used the word clothes, it's interesting to me that we have a story of treachery and the ultimate, what do you call this? The ultimate, what's the word I just used in English? A husband can do to a wife?
Betrayal.
The ultimate betrayal is to sell you as a slave, right? And so here we have a story that is pivoting around a piece of clothing and it's dealing with betrayal. So it's interesting that there does exist in the language a wordplay that could be, at least in someone's subconscious, possibly, well, I think it would rise up to the conscious at some point.
And you have to give more words like that, like ksut, from the sword to cover up.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's an idea that is in the language.
Like, like in this passage you're saying?
Who knows? If it, the begot and the begot, I think there's a very conscious connection between them. If you see it also, in other words, you use for clothing and also for covering up.
Where is kasut in here?
Well, not in this one.
Oh,
in general.
Okay.
There is a connection.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. In general, there could be. And people can, if you know the language well, and this is inside of you, you can play with this. And
it's
can
the same
add
in English, isn't it?
Meaning.
A, you know.
A cover-up?
You cover up something. It's treasury.
Right.
But I'm covering my body, but it's the same word.
But we don't really say that. We say, oh, I'm going to get covered today. So it's not strong.
Right.
Or nice.
Well, it's the kind of thing that you only notice when you're thinking about each word in the story and starting to think. And it's a word, it's what I started to think about when I was going from here to here. Because, let's do this. Do you like that? All the arrows? Okay, go to Isaiah 32. And we have to finish quickly. I don't know if we'll get to Ezekiel, but Ezekiel talks, I already mentioned the link of shalom, which is the opposite of what we have described in Genesis 37. Why do you keep doing that on me? Oh. It's going into Greek on me. Okay. And my people will live in Neve Shalom, in a peaceful
dwelling.
Yeah. Uvemishkenot miftachim, uvemenuchot sha'ananot. So this whole idea of secure and safe and quiet. And then, even if the forest is destroyed and the city is annihilated or brought low, you will be blessed. You who plant seed by all the banks of the streams, you who let your ox and donkey graze. Okay. We have the sending out of the foot of the ox. We also had Joseph being sent out twice. That's just a literal connection between the two places. But then essentially is in Isaiah 33:1. Hoy shoded v'ata lo shadud. Uvoged velo vagduvo. Okay, these are some tough verses, but Isaiah 31, the destroyer, my translation says the destroyer, you could shoded is like a robber, right? The destroyer is as good as dead, you who have not been destroyed. The deceitful one is as good as dead. And that word deceitful one is boged, the betrayer. And they didn't betray him. Okay, so we have boged. Does anyone have betrayer there?
Yes, I have betrayer.
Can you read your verse in 31?
Woe to you, destroyer, you have not been destroyed. Woe to you, betrayer, who have not yet been betrayed. When you stop destroying, you will be destroyed. When you stop betraying, you will be betrayed.
Okay.
But it's boged with a vav, is it?
Well, here it is, but it can be written with or without the vav. Boged. So it's interesting, we have this link based on betraying, which of course is exactly what they're doing in Joseph, even though they have never yet used that word, right? So they're telling the whole story using synonyms, other bad things, but never the word betrayal. But we all think of this story of Joseph as an ultimate betrayal story. And so I think that is actually what's connecting those two things. And then there is the whole betrayal and clothes little play. It's like an English, you know, son, and they sound the same in different words. Only in Hebrew they're actually written the same as well, but they're different words. Okay. And then it goes on to say in Isaiah, when you are through destroying, you will be destroyed. When you finish deceiving, others will deceive you. That is verse. Okay, so where is my verse? Even in that verse 1, it's got some interesting things going on. The Greeks, athetundes, is the same word they use to translate livgod, to betray. So the Greek translation is a little more literal there. But then they do something really strange. They say, like a moth on a piece of garment, like that you will be overcome. So they actually read livgod there as beged. So in the Greek translation, you already see how there's this, anytime you come up with these letters, you kind of have to figure out what's going on. They obviously had a text, or they had this text and were trying to make sense of it. There is no mention in Hebrew of moth, which is ash. But it is kind of strange wording. It's a difficult verse.
I just wanted to say that when you're finished betraying, then you will be betrayed. It reminds me of Joseph after his, Jacob after his betrayal, Esau, he then flees to Laban.
And then he becomes betrayed.
But still, that's not the end of the story. So there's still hope.
Right. So if Joseph is betrayed, well, Joseph continues to be betrayed. And a moth on a cloth, oh, that works too. A moth on a cloth is somehow an image of being destroyed.
Devoured.
Devoured. But in the Greek it says you will be overcome or defeated like a moth on a cloth. So it's very interesting. They kind of waxed poetic there. So then
maybe it ties up with verse 4. So instead of being moths, it's the locusts who are devouring.
Yeah, I as I read on, I thought that must be what was going on. They back read into the earlier verses some metaphors from the later verses. Goes on to say, Lord, be merciful to us. We wait for you. Give us strength each morning. Deliver us when distress comes. And this word for strength there is really just an arm, mighty arm. And the nations run away when they hear a loud noise. The nations scatter when you spring into action. Your plunder disappears as if locusts were eating it. So there we have a similar metaphor. But there, and then usaf, the word for being gathered, is being played on the word for the locusts eating it, because to gather it up can be to also consume it. And you have several words. And the Greek there is interesting. They don't know what to do with the words. And they see the locust and the caterpillar, and they say, your plunder will be gathered up, the little and the big. So I guess the caterpillar is the little and the locust leaping is the big. I don't know. It's a very difficult passage to translate. And then they say, like someone gathering up spiders. Oh, no, there's locusts. I'm thinking of the other place. There are other passages where they change it to spider. I don't know why. So it's kind of confusing words in the Hebrew.
Is there a connection between Joseph, which is sort of to be added to, isn't it, his name?
Yeah.
And this gathering up.
Gathering, there isn't a direct, like they aren't the same word, but they sound similar, and you can make puns off of it. This word to gather is asaf. There you go. There's a little asaf over there. And Yosef is yasaf, that's the root. So you can play off of that. And it could be that was in the back of the people's minds connecting to these passages, even though the overarching theme is already there of betrayal. The other thing I want to mention, also you have mentioned in verse 3 of the nations wandering, nadadu, to be caused to wander away. And so Joseph was caused to wander away from Canaan. And nafotsu goyim, the nations are scattered. And it seems kind of like a reversal. As we read on in English, the Lord is exalted indeed. He lives in heaven. He fills Zion with justice and fairness. He's your constant source of stability. He abundantly provides safety and great wisdom. And there we're dealing with shalom in one of those places again. Wait, where are we? In Malachi Shalom in verse 7. He gives all this to those who fear him. Look, ambassadors cry out in the street. Messengers sent to make peace weep bitterly. There's my Malachi Shalom. Highways are empty. There are no travelers. Treaties are broken. Witnesses are despised. Human life is treated with disrespect. The land dries up and withers away. The forest of Lebanon shrivels up and decays. Sharon is like the desert. Which Sharon is the area, you know, in the coastal lands that is known for it being a fertile, good, straight, flat land. So this is like an inverse of that, to become a desert. Bashan and Carmel are parched.
Wait, I've got to drop their leaves, so that's exactly the same. Here we've got the forest dropping their leaves and becoming desert.
Yeah.
But I was thinking in verse 5, the key really is the fear of the Lord is the key to this treasure.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever's been going on before, whether it's betrayal or whether it's deception or whether it's the moth destroying or whatever it is, God is in control. He's exalted. He'll fill Zion with his justice and righteousness. He'll be the sure foundation for your times, a rich store of salvation and wisdom and knowledge. The fear of the Lord is the key to this treasure.
And it says, you who are far away, in verse 13, you who are far away, listen to what I have done. Usually references to you who are far away are talking about Gentiles, but it could be talking about people who have left following God.
Yeah.
Right? So that's kind of how we understand it. To be far away from God, you don't feel the closeness. You haven't been pursuing him. You feel like he's not there. But listen, like they're going to see it too. And you who are close are also going to recognize his strength. And it also reminds me of our story. We had mentioned that Joseph, when he was far away, they had evil plans for him. Those are just verbal connections. So to finish off this section of sinners are afraid in Zion, panic grips the godless. They say, who among us can coexist with destructive fire? Who among us can coexist with unquenchable fire? The one who lives uprightly and speaks honestly. The one who refuses to profit from oppressive measures and rejects a bribe. The one who does not plot violent crimes and does not seek to harm others. This is a person who will live in a secure place. He will find safety in the Rocky Mountain strongholds. Okay, so back to what you were saying. What is the key to this safety and security? Is not wanting profit from oppressiveness. And not taking bribes. And all basically you have a list of everything that is mentioned or alluded to in the Joseph story. We have the word betza, that's profit. And it even says Ma'ashakot Noel. Well, that wouldn't be Noel Kapav, it is. Shochad is a bribe. Anyway, so we'll continue on next week with the story of Joseph. And right now we're in confusion because he does speak truth. So in that sense, and he has listened to his dreams. So he seems like he fears the Lord. And he's going to speak honestly. And so now it's up to God to give him that safety and security, which he obviously really, really lacks, being in a foreign land and oppressed as a slave. So I'll leave you to ponder that. And if you can make your way down to the worship service, it will be starting just about now. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Thank you, Sharon.